Hi, I'm Eric Dalma, pastor at Gospel of Grace Fellowship. Today we have a special message preached by Bob DeWay about how Jesus demonstrated his power over forces that the people greatly feared. They feared the forces of nature and the power of the demonic. Jesus rebuked the wind and waves and then delivered a man filled with demons. May this message encourage you in your faith. God bless.
Now let's turn to our section, Luke 8, beginning with verse 22. Verses 22 and 23. It says, "Now on one of those days, Jesus and his disciples got into a boat, and he said to them, 'Let us go over to the other side of the lake.' So they launched out. But as they were sailing along, he fell asleep, and a fierce gale of wind descended on the lake, and they began to be swamped and to be in danger." Now, this, the Sea of Galilee, by the way, is indeed a lake. And I've been on it back in 83. I just talked to an old friend who had gone to Israel for the first time, and he said the same thing. "Well, that's a lake. It's not even as big as Lake Minnetonka." That's true. But nevertheless, you need to remember a couple things about the Jewish people. They weren't basically known as seagoers. And if you read the Old Testament, you'll see that many of the mentions of the sea are kind of ominous. The sea is a place of torment. It's a place of death. It's a place to be feared. Now, even though some of the disciples were fishermen, they knew very well that in the crude vessels that they had to navigate Galilee, that a terrible storm could be fatal. So we have them launching, and here Jesus falls asleep. It's interesting. The only other case in the Bible where it notes someone falling asleep in the middle of a storm was Jonah, of all people, in the Old Testament. Jonah was sleeping, and remember, they cast lots, and they were trying to find out, okay, somebody's God is mad at them. Which one is it? And they finally figured out, Jonah finally confessed, "Well, I'm rebelling against God, and if you want this thing to stop, just throw me overboard." So Jesus is sleeping in the boat as his disciples are in the boat. Now, it doesn't say how many of them got in there. Earlier in Luke 8, there were the women and then the 12, and there were others, and then there was a bigger crowd. And so it doesn't specify how many disciples are with him, perhaps just the 12. So they had seen Jesus' power earlier in Luke 5 at the lake. Remember in Luke 5, he had gone out to speak? And then they had this great catch of fish, and then he said, "You'll be fishers of men." So this is yet another incident where Jesus is going to do a mighty deed on the lake that would show his power. And in the previous incident, Peter actually, when they got the big catch of fish, he said, "Depart from me, Lord, I'm a sinful man." He realized that he was in the presence of the Son of God, and that his sins are a horrible thing in the presence of God. That was in Luke chapter 5. This is interesting also because Luke always likes to preview things, do previews and reviews and foreshadowing, and he does so in such marvelous ways. I love Luke Acts. For example, in the beginning of Luke 8, we have these women who accompany Jesus and serve. And later, they show up again as the ones at the tomb. And then later in Acts, they show up again as people there at prayer. So in this case, we have this danger at sea. And then before we're done with Luke Acts, we have the same thing happening to Paul in Acts 27 when they had the shipwreck. And God miraculously intervened for Paul in that case. Luke is definitely setting up things for the future here. Luke 8 and verse 24. They came to Jesus and woke him up, saying, "Master, Master, we are perishing." And he got up and rebuked the wind and the surging waves, and they stopped, and it became calm. So the word rebuked here is the same word used earlier in Luke for Jesus rebuking demons. And so in a sense, the terminology in the situation, it's as if the storm itself is a sign of nature being fallen and being a danger to humans. Did you know that for most of human history, man has been trying to survive nature? And that even in the last 100 years, things have changed so dramatically as far as how people in America viewed nature. My grandfather farmed in the middle part of the 20th century, and he spent his entire life battling against nature for survival. They had the Dust Bowl of the 30s. They had droughts. They had plagues. Their wells would run dry, and he could never keep enough water to water his cattle in July and August. He'd have to haul water from somewhere else. And so he spent his whole life in a battle against nature to just survive and to have that farm and to have enough to take care of his family. And he drilled a 400-foot drill well just so they'd have water right out of an aquifer so the animals would always be fed. But, you know, the thing that's changed in my lifetime is that now people, rather than seeing nature as a threat to kill them, they worship nature as if it were a goddess. Especially in America, we've become so pagan that we think that the universe somehow has a personality and that nature is somehow a goddess and that nature will take care of us. And so they see anything that humans do to survive as evil, and that nature is this mother that will just take care of you if you just let her. Okay? And so the reason I'm bringing this up is that if we don't see that this silly pagan view that many have today is what it is, which is foolishness and a big lie, then we can't understand why this passage is in the Bible. Because nature was viewed as a threat to destroy human life. It still is. It's just that we think we can always overcome it with technology, or we think we're in charge of it or something like that. But most of the human history, man was at the mercy of nature and was likely not even to have enough food to eat or shelter from the storm. But here we see that God himself, in the person of Jesus Christ, has authority over nature. And we need to start getting the lesson. The lesson isn't that Mother Earth is going to take care of us. The lesson is that we live in a sinful world, and that life is fragile, and that these tsunamis and earthquakes and hurricanes and things that are lashing the earth are a sign that we need to repent. So the fact that Jesus can do this is a sign he's God. He has power over nature itself. And the fact here that we have in the Bible a promise that someday when Jesus returns and he reigns upon the earth, that the earth will be transformed and that it will again not be an enemy to man as far as likely to kill us and destroy us. The lion will lie down with the lamb. So let's move on now. So after we've seen this power over nature, the next pericope or section of story is Luke 8:25, and it's about the gathering demoniac. Oh, excuse me. First of all, we've got to talk about this faith. And he said to them, "Where is your faith?" Now, this is an amazing statement. Where is your faith? They were fearful and amazed, saying, "Who is this then? Who is this? Where is your faith?" Now, you might think, man, he's asking off a lot of these guys. If you're in a boat and it's sinking, you don't expect somebody can just say, "Okay, that's enough of this. Stop." They never experienced that. These are fishermen, and they know when they're going to perish. And he says, "Where is your faith?" Well, what's he expecting of them? He's expecting that they've learned from what they've seen. They've seen him do miracles. They've heard his teaching. They've come to know him to be the Son of God. And so, therefore, their faith should have been in Christ, and they should have realized that he has the power over all things and that he has their best interest in mind and that he'll care for them. But this is a process. So their faith is still weak. They're supposed to be like that fourth soil and receive the word deep into their heart and have strong faith. But this is still a process. Later, this will come up again. Later, we will see this issue with Peter and the others and the fact that they need more faith. But he says, "Where is your faith? Who is this then?" See that phrase, "Who then is this?" That's the question that's being answered by Luke. Who then is this? And the answer is, this is Jesus Christ, the Jewish Messiah, the Son of God, fully human, he fell asleep, fully God, he rebukes the wind and the sea, and this is the one in whom we must place our faith. The faith that they should have had was more faith in Jesus. He commands the winds and water, and they obey him. Because why? Jesus is the Creator. The Creator has power and authority over the creation. And he is who he claims to be. The fear and amazement, by the way, in Luke Acts is a typical response to a theophany. They are amazed. That word is used 16 times in Luke Acts for a response to a mighty work of God. So God's done a mighty work, and they are amazed. So the key point is that Yahweh controls the winds and the waves. Jesus controls the winds and the waves. Therefore, Jesus has the very power and authority of God himself. Let's go to the Psalms. And these would be known to these disciples. I'll read them so you can get it. I just have the reference on the slide. Psalm 65:7. Who stills the roaring seas, the roaring of their waves, and the tumult of the peoples? And this was talking about God. Psalm 89:9. You rule the swelling of the sea when its waves rise. You still them. Psalm 106:9. Thus he rebuked the Red Sea, and he dried it up, and he led them through the deeps as through the wilderness. Psalm 107:29. He caused the storm to be still. Isn't that interesting? In the Psalms, it says God causes the storm to be still. And here it says he caused the storm to be still so that the waves of the sea were hushed. In another gospel, Jesus says, peace, be still. And so with that Old Testament background, we can understand that the claim that Luke is making has to do with the very deity of Christ. He does what only God can do. Now we'll go to the Gadarene story. Luke 8:26. Then they sailed to the country of the Gerasenes, which is opposite Galilee. And when he came out under the land, he was met by a man from the city who was possessed with demons and who had not put on any clothing for a long time and was not living in a house but in the tombs. Now, we're getting here a picture of the worst possible scenario. In fact, this guy is portrayed as being about as bad off spiritually and physically as any man could be. It just doesn't get much worse. Now, for the Jewish people in particular, this is really bad because everything about this situation is unclean. It's a Gentile territory where he went. It's unclean. There's a story involved with pigs. Unclean. He's in the tombs. Unclean. He's demonized. Unclean spirit. It's unclean, 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 unclean. This is bad. Don't go there. Okay? So this is a powerful story that's setting up here something that we can know about Jesus Christ. So now we know he's like God who can calm the sea. Now he's going into the most miserable place, in an unclean place, and confronting the powers of Satan that are keeping a man in unmitigated bondage and living as a maniac, naked, in the tombs, a place associated with death. So this man had crossed all boundaries of human decency and was in a very, very severe situation. It couldn't be imagined to be any worse. Luke 8:28. Seeing Jesus, he cried out and fell before him and said in a loud voice, "What business do we have with each other, Jesus, Son of the Most High? I beg you, do not torment me." Now it becomes clear, this is the demon. This is the demon talking here. All right? Don't torment me. Immediately, the demon recognizes who Jesus is, and we see this elsewhere in the Gospels. And that this phrase, the Son of the Most High, was used, by the way, in Acts 16 when there was a slave girl who did divination. And the spirit in her sees this. Not that that term isn't used by others. The angel Gabriel called Jesus the Son of the Most High as well. So this crying out and falling before him is something that's happening, as we'll see in the next verse, because of what Jesus had done, which was commanding the unclean spirit to come out. But he says, "What business do we have with each other?" That's an interpretation. The Greek literally says, "What to me and to you." That's all it says, "What to me and to you." But that was a phrase that you find in the Bible, and it really means what the New American Standard says. Okay, we have nothing in common. There, what's between us? What's between us, anyhow? And notice that this demon, it turns out to be many demons, knows that he was before one with absolute power. He said, "Have you come to torment me?" It says in Matthew, it has the phrase, "before the time." So this demon knows, as Satan does, that his days are numbered. And he knows that God is not going to allow Satan and his minions to continually have free reign upon the earth to deceive and to torment and to do whatever things they can get by with, that God lets them get by with. They know that this won't go on forever, that there's a time when it'll be stopped because God will come and finish it. But here he says, "Are you going to torment me?" So the demon here in the singular in this verse is talking and is worried about being tormented. Now verse 29 gives us further explanation. "For he had commanded the unclean spirit to come out of the man. For it had seized him many times, and he was bound with chains and shackles and kept under guard, and yet he would break his bonds and be driven by the demon into the desert." As I said, this man was in the most horrible of all possible conditions, tormented in body and soul, driven from mankind and civilization, living amongst tombs and out of his mind, seized. It seized him, it says here. And so this is Luke giving us a narrative aside, explaining this situation and how bad it was. So the demon's power was great to do this to a man, but he's now confronting Jesus' greater power. So Jesus had just shown his great power over nature and described as a personification the calming of the sea. It's as if nature itself was a demon trying to destroy man, and now there's a literal demon trying to destroy man. So Jesus is confronting all of the powers that are arrayed against us. Nature, demons, sickness, and death. He's greater than them all. So that's what we're learning from Luke here. Now let's look at verses 30 and 31. Luke 8, 30 and 31. It says here, "And Jesus asked him, 'What is your name?' And he said, 'Legion,' for many demons had entered him, and they were imploring him not to command them to go away into the abyss." Now, this abyss is mentioned elsewhere in the Bible. And in Revelation 20 and 3, Satan is put there during for 1,000 years into the abyss. In Revelation 9, 1, there are demons that are let loose out of the abyss to come out and torment the people on the face of the earth. So this abyss was not where these demons want to go. Now, a legion in the Roman army was between 5,600 and 6,000 men. So whether this is to be taken as exactly how many demons, it's not clear here, but it means there were many. It says that. So this guy is in a horrible state. Now, I want to correct something. People are oftentimes using scriptures for what they're not trying to tell us. There's a theory that if you want to get a demon to leave somebody, you have to find out the demon's name. And they based that on this passage. See, Jesus asked the name, but this was not common. It's not what Jesus did elsewhere. And there was indeed a popular belief in the ancient world that if you could find out the name of a demon or a spirit, that would give you power over such a thing. But Luke isn't telling us this to suggest that Jesus needed to know a name or he'd have no power over the demon. That would be the opposite of what Luke is saying. See, to interpret the Bible, really what you're doing is learning how to read. Okay? You read the Bible. Now, what is Luke telling us? Is Luke telling us that Jesus was stymied unless he could find out the name? That is not what Luke is saying. Luke is saying that Jesus has all power and authority, and he does so in every one of the co-text is the texts that go along with it. I can only think of the scholarly term. The four pericopes, no, that's scholarly too. The four stories that are related, those are all to be read together. The power over the sea, power over the demon, power over sickness, power over death. Those four stories are related to each other. And what Luke is telling us in each one is very similar. Jesus has power. So then to come and say in the middle of this whole section that here he actually didn't have power unless he knew a name and thereby perpetuate a pagan myth that if you get no names, you could get demons to go, is really a very poor reading. That's the best I can say about it. It's not a very good reading. You need to read. So then in Luke's case, why is this here? That's a valid question. Why does it say legion? Why does he ask his name? Because it's setting up for us this thing about the swine and is reinforcing how bad this guy's condition. We need to know this because Luke wants us, under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, to know that this guy's in the worst condition anybody could ever be in and more demonized than anybody else ever could imagine to be, and he can be delivered. And so the point is, whatever's wrong with you, I think God can deal with that too. Okay, whatever's going on, you're not half as bad as this guy. All right, so that makes sense. So that's why the legion, just because we need to know this is really bad, and it also sets up the thing about the swine. So he says here, don't send us into the abyss. Now look at verse 32. Now there was a herd of many swine feeding there on the mountain, showing us, of course, this is a Gentile territory. This is certainly not the Jews'. Swine are unclean, right? So the swine are on the mountain, and the demons implored him to permit them to enter the swine. And he gave them permission. And the demons came out of the man, entered the swine, and the herd rushed down the steep bank into the lake and was drowned. So these evil spiritual forces, which are real, by the way, this isn't mythological, these spiritual forces that were driving the man into the tombs, the place associated with death, drive the pigs to their death and destroy the herd. So here we have a situation where all of the unclean things that can be imagined are all coming together. The unclean demons, the unclean spirit, the unclean tombs, the unclean swine, death, awful situation. Now let's look at verse 34. It says here, when the herdsmen saw what had happened, they ran away and reported it in the city and out in the country. The people went out to see what had happened, and they came to Jesus and found the man from whom the demons had gone out, sitting down at the feet of Jesus, clothed and in his right mind, and they became frightened. Wow! In the ancient world, in a small area or a country area like this, everybody in the city knew about this man. I mean, this would be the most famous person, or infamous as the case would be. There wouldn't be anybody that didn't know that there was a wild, insane man running naked in the tombs. It would probably make you not want to go visit the gravesite of anybody knowing he was there. And so this becomes kind of a missionary opportunity because this gets spread to the people in the community, and they find out everything that happened. Sitting at the feet of Jesus, in Luke Acts, sitting at the feet is a discipleship posture. Mary and Martha, sitting at the feet. When Paul, using Jewish terminology, described his previous instruction under the great Rabbi Gamaliel, he said, I sat at his feet. I learned at his feet. So that was the posture of a disciple before the master or before the rabbi. So can you imagine that this unclean guy, naked, wild, demonized, tormented, suddenly is sitting at Jesus' feet as a disciple. Luke is portraying this guy as a believer, as a disciple, in his right mind, and fully clothed. Jesus has power over the worst imaginable human situation. And he can save anybody. I'm going to have some applications about this. This is supposed to give us confidence in the power of the gospel. That people that are in horrible spiritual bondage can be delivered. And they aren't delivered through spiritual technology. They're not delivered because somebody learned the name of the demon. They're not delivered because somebody did an exorcism. They're only delivered by Jesus Christ. And it says that when we come to him, we're transferred out of the dominion of Satan into the kingdom of the Son of his love. It says that in Colossians. Now let's take this a little bit further. So we have a total reversal of the situation. But look at the next verse, verse 36. Those who had seen it reported to them how the man who was demon-possessed had been made well. But Luke is telling us even more. The phrase made well in English is a translation of sozo, the Greek word for saved. And so they said, he's been saved. And I believe Luke wants us to take that in the most comprehensive sense of the word. Saved from his situation and brought to faith in Jesus Christ. Amen. So there's a man totally saved. I mean, saved.
Well, again, we're out of time for this edition of Critical Issues Commentary Radio. We both want to remind you out there that you can access this program at our website at cicministry.org. Bob, it's a real pleasure getting into these verses. Well, we want to remind all of you out there, as it says in Philippians 1:27, to stand firm in one spirit with one mind and strive together for the faith of the gospel.